Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
We had a terrific night at the Fitzgerald Theater last night with Talking Volumes and Carl Hiaasen. And I have to say, we could hear the thunder booming and the lightning crackling. And we didn't care because we were having such a good time. You can hear that show. If you weren't in the audience, didn't make it to the show, you can hear it next week on NPR Presents. And I'll let you know which day.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by Pentair, the official sustainable water provider to the Minnesota Twins. You can learn more online at pentair.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on where the military fits into our politics and our culture.
Maybe a combination of my plan and the general's plan, or the general's plan. If I like their plan, Matt, I'm not going to call you up and say, Matt, we have a great plan. Today, you probably saw, I have a piece of paper here I could show it. 88 generals and admirals endorsed me today.
A couple of weeks ago, Clinton and Trump went toe-to-toe on how many military generals' endorsements they'd gathered. General Michael Flynn, who supports Donald Trump, told The Times, we had to stop accepting names because we were running out of time. The candidates are also talking about their plans for the VA and how they would position the military abroad. Rosa Brooks was deeply embedded in that military culture in a professional turn of events that she says was like, quote, conducting anthropological field work in some exotic and unpredictable foreign tribe. Brought up in a left-wing family, working as a law professor, she entered the mysterious and bewildering world of the Pentagon with a certain amount of trepidation. What she learned there informs her views on warfare, geopolitics, military deployment. And we're going to talk with Rosa this morning and a lieutenant general of the military. But I want to hear from you as well. If you or someone in your family is a member of the military, I'd like your thoughts on what you're hearing from the candidates on the subject. And I think we'll hear more on Monday in the first debate. And whether your military service informs your vote on election day. So what are you hearing from the candidates? Is the fact that you have served or someone in your family has served influencing the way you're thinking about this election and will influence your vote on election day? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Our guest today, Rosa Brooks, is the author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. And she's with us today from Washington. And if first names are all right, Rosa, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Rosa is great.
All right. Thank you. And David Barno is with us. He's a former commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan. He's a fellow at the Atlantic Council. And David, if first names are all right with you, welcome. Good to have you here.
That sounds great. Thanks, Gary.
Rosa, I read your post from late July about Donald Trump being the peace candidate.
A little bit tongue-in-cheek.
That's what I thought, with a fair amount of surprise. And yet, I have to say there was a certain amount of logic to it. Do you want to explain what you were wrestling with there?
Donald Trump, as we all know, has been running around talking about how wonderful Vladimir Putin is. And Vladimir Putin, strangely enough, has been running around talking about how wonderful Donald Trump is. And as it was a tongue-in-cheek column, I did suggest that perhaps if we want to end the decades of misunderstanding and enmity with the former Soviet Union, with the Russians, elect Donald Trump, and we will soon be having beauty pageants shared between the White House and Moscow, and peace will break out all over. In real life, I'm not particularly sanguine that Donald Trump will usher in a more peaceful world, though.
No, but you are. Some of the questions that were raised for me is that relationships between world leaders can matter in a very complex situation where, let's say with the Russians, we need them in one way, we oppose some of their policies in places like Syria, but we needed them for negotiations with Iran. It's a complex world where you can't say they're our enemies and we're never going to deal with them.
That's absolutely right. And I think that certainly Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have also both taken the position that You have to be able to talk to everybody, that you need to negotiate with your enemies. You don't have to negotiate with your friends. That having relationships so that you can work with even leaders who you do not like is still important. That doesn't mean that you have to be excessively trusting and assume that they're going to do what you want them to do, but that those lines of communication need to be open.
David, can I ask you for your thoughts on the level of discourse about the military and deployments specifically that you've heard so far in the campaign?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag out there. I should note that Mr. Trump and former Secretary Clinton both have a number of retired, not active duty, but retired generals and admirals that are lined up behind them. I actually don't think that's healthy for the nation's military and for the civil military discourse. I'm politically an independent, and I'm not endorsing either candidate. I don't think retired generals and admirals should endorse
Why?
Either candidate, because I think it reflects back on how new administrations look at their active duty generals and admirals. If you're serving as a general officer and you're providing advice, which is your role as an apolitical member of what the profession of arms, as it's called inside the military, and then 2 weeks later you step out of uniform, you retire, and you became an advocate for a party that's actually running against your commander-in-chief of 2 weeks earlier, that casts some questions on whether the military is really apolitical or not. So I've got some issues, and that's my personal opinion. That's not widely held, and certainly, military officers have rights as citizens, but I think the ones that pin stars on their shoulders have a different set of responsibilities when they leave the military than those that retire as sergeants major or lieutenant colonels.
I just want to ask you one more question about that. I have to say that the fact that someone has served in the military, no matter where they are on that level, at your high level or not, for me, I probably listen more closely to their thoughts about the candidates. I mean, an endorsement, these were dueling endorsements between the
exactly.
candidates, but I give that some thought, and why shouldn't I?
Well, of course, I don't disagree with that, and I think the military officers that retired should be able to give advice to candidates and to different elements that are trying to learn more about national security policy and about the nature of wars and what it takes to fight wars and what kind of military we should have. But I don't think they should be out there at political conventions endorsing candidates, because when one of those two candidates get elected and they meet their first set of active duty generals in meetings, they're going to wonder if these folks can be trusted. They're going to wonder if they disagree with a policy, they're going to go out and start campaigning against the very folks that they were working with a few weeks earlier. So I think that's unhealthy for the profession. I agree that they should be able to give advice, but I would prefer to see that in private.
I see. Rosa, do you have a view on that?
I think it's a complicated issue, because there's obviously a really fine line between both active duty military personnel and retired military personnel giving their opinions on, does this strategy make sense given their own backgrounds and expertise, versus coming right out and standing up there at the Republican convention or the Democratic convention. And I think you can draw a distinction between the two, but I think in many cases there's a sort of murkier situation where you have someone who's not necessarily at the convention but is just saying, I think this idea of Trump's is crazy. And it's difficult, because like you, as a citizen, I want to hear what people who have had some skin in the game
right.
think. I think the unhealthy thing maybe is goes back even deeper than this, though, and it's something that Dave Barno has done a lot of work on as well. Right now, we have a situation where Americans really have lost faith in most of our public institutions, and you see this year after year in public polls on whether do Americans trust the presidency? Do they trust the police? Do they trust Congress? Do they trust the Supreme Court? And they don't really have a lot of faith in those institutions. But if you say, do you trust the military? Confidence in the military is up above 70% of Americans.
It's pretty
extraordinary,
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that in a nation in which there's a really widespread feeling of we can't rely on anybody except the military, it's that puts a huge amount of pressure on military folks to be what, on some level, it's they just can't be. They're that they're human beings. Some of them are experts on foreign policy. Some of them are not. And we put them up on a pedestal, and then we're very disappointed in them if they don't behave the way we expect them to.
And David, you'd concur with that?
I think that's right. And I think that there's absolutely nothing wrong, and it's actually beneficial for the nation to hear from military officers what they think about various positions. But I also think if those same military officers are endorsing candidates publicly at the same time they hold those positions and share them, then their opinions become suspect. You know, I'd rather see military officers continue. This is senior officers now, generals and admirals, people that have been in the military 35 years before they retire. This is their life. You know, they're going to have general or admiral in front of their name until they die. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. And so Americans tend to conflate them with folks that are still serving as active duty generals. When Mr. Trump talked about having endorsements, he talked about endorsements from generals, not from retired generals. So, and the public kind of sees those very much the same. So I very much appreciate people sharing their ideas on foreign policy, testifying in front of Congress after they've retired from the military. But if they're at the same time publicly, you know, promoting a single candidate, then that tends to politicize those views more than what the public might want to see.
Interesting observation here, David, from Tom online. He says, this discussion highlights the major issue with how the military is treated in politics and modern society. The military shouldn't be treated as the driving force of our foreign policy, but rather an arrow in our quiver of foreign policy tools. How would you approach that?
Well, that topic is right in the middle of Rosa Brooks's wheelhouse
it
in her
is.
Last book here, which is fantastic. And it basically makes the point that the military has become so capable and is so well-funded and has so many different abilities to get things that are difficult done around the world that it's become the go-to for almost every problem. So I think that's exactly right. It should be one of the arrows in the quiver, but because of its capabilities and because of, you know, the fact that it's widely deployed around the world and it has every kind of capability in its toolkit, from helicopters to logistics to, you know, humanitarian relief, it gets called on for every conceivable mission. And that's probably not healthy when the other elements of the government are not as well resourced and ought to be doing some of those functions.
And Rosa, I think you speak to this in this just a short excerpt here from the book. You write, the distinction between war and non-war may be arbitrary, but we want it to be sharp and clear. It sounds like you're concerned that that distinction isn't sharp and clear.
I think it has gotten a lot less sharp and clear than it used to be. And you know, there have always been a little bit of blurriness on the margins, but particularly in the post 9/11 globalized world, in which threats have become very diffuse often. You know, that at the very same time we continue to face threats from powerful state adversaries, we also face threats from actors in cyberspace, we face threats from non-state terrorist networks that cut across borders, from super empowered individuals. You know, it has just gotten, from an analytic perspective, harder and harder to be really clear about what category legally and politically we want those things to fit into. And I think we've gotten into a bad habit since 9/11 of viewing every new problem through the lens of war, which in turn means that you view every problem as a problem that should be solved by the military. And as Dave said, Dave said to me something once that really influenced how I thought about this issue. You know, he said the military has become a kind of super Walmart with everything under one roof. And much like Walmart the store, you know, the military can exploit economies of scale that smaller parts of the U.S. government can't achieve. And it's often said, and it is in fact true, that there are more members of military marching bands than members of the U.S. Foreign Service. So
wow.
Any problem, pick a problem, the civilian institutions we have don't have the capabilities to respond very frequently. And so we turn to the military. And that then leads us into this vicious circle where the more we think of as a military job, the more we are inclined to view things through the lens of war. The more we view things through the lens of war, the more we think they're military jobs.
So, David, as Rosa says here, she writes that in many ways the military is a victim of its own success. But I want to ask what kind of a role the military itself, military leadership, has played in that.
Well, I'm not sure. I think clearly the fact that the military has been involved in so many of these different operations, and that you've got a long-serving, apolitical, professional body of very, very capable leaders in the military that is, you pointed out, are trusted, you know, at a far higher level than any other set of institutional leaders in the nation by the country, by the people in the country. They've been out and they've been tested. They've been at war for 15 years. This particular corps of generals and admirals and the Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Marines, They've had more battle experience than any generation in American history, and they're a pretty remarkable group of people. I mean, there was a lot of commentary about whether whether the military generals have been rubbled by the administration.
Right.
this group is a remarkable group, and I've been, you know, out of the military, retired for about 10 years now, but the people that are serving today as generals, when 9/11 happened, they were captains and majors. They've spent the last 15 years of their life deployed overseas on 3 or 4 or 5 combat deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. They've made huge sacrifices, and they also have some incredible experience getting really hard things done in difficult parts of the world. So I think they have their shortcomings. They're in a very insular world that's separated in a lot of ways from the rest of American society, but they've done some remarkable things, and I think the public recognizes them for that.
I guess, Rosa, I was thinking about when there is a debate about whether the United States should deploy troops on the ground to a place like Syria. I mean, you know what that sounded like, and you know what President Obama has said in some of these longer interviews that he's given about the discussion about deploying troops to Syria. I mean, it seems like there are members of the military establishment who are ready and eager to go to take on that kind of responsibility, which is why I'm asking, is the military in some ways responsible for, you know, being this victim of its own success? Do you know what I'm asking?
I think so. I mean, I think that one of the amazing things about the military, which can cause problems, is that the attitude from top to bottom is usually, bring it on.
Yes.
Whatever you need us to do, we'll do it. You know, point us towards a problem and we'll solve it. And that is obviously a good thing and a rare thing. And I think certainly throughout the last 15 years, one of the things we've seen is that we may want to have more civilian diplomats, development experts, and so forth in Iraq and Afghanistan. But if you say to a civilian at the State Department, off you go to Iraq, they can say no. And sometimes they do. And fairly often they do. They say, I'm sorry, you know, I'd like to help, but I have young children and so on. And I don't want to go to a war zone right now. I can't do it. If you say to a member of the military, we'd like you to go to Iraq, they say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Because that's their job. That's their legal obligation. And people who join the military join knowing that. I think it's not so much that I would blame the military for that, but I do think it becomes so tempting for policymakers, you know, whether you're sitting in Congress or you're sitting in the White House, you've got this institution that is open 24/7, will go where you send it, and can't say no at the end of the day. They may say, as indeed they senior military officials very often do, particularly in context of things like Syria, they may say, I'm not sure this is a great idea. I'm not, you know, I don't think the strategy has been thought through. You know, I'm concerned about the following unintended consequences and issues you haven't thought of. But at the end of the day, if the president says go, they go.
This is a conversation, if you just tuned in, about where the military fits into our foreign policy, our politics, our culture. Rosa Brooks is with us. She's the author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. She has a really interesting chapter about future warfare and the individualization of warfare. We'll talk about that as well. David Barno with us. He's a former commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan and a fellow at the Atlantic Council. And I'm asking you, as you track along with the discussion here, if you or someone in your family is a member of the military, I'd like your thoughts on how you're hearing the shaping of discussion of these ideas on the campaign trail, and then how your military service influences your vote on Election Day. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR, where Vaughn says it's surreal to see Trump openly disrespect people like John McCain, Houman Khan, and still get support from many fellow military at the lower ranks of my unit. There were a share of both Sanders and Trump supporters, also a universal skepticism of Clinton. And to the phones to David in Excelsior. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. Good
morning.
My point would be, I think we're placing too much emphasis on the military and its so-called success. My first point would be, name the wars that the U.S. has won since World War II other than invading countries like Grenada and, also there are people weighing in on both sides of the Clinton and Trump divide, and consequently it's also showing divide in there.
Are you someone who has served, David?
I am a veteran, yes.
Okay. I really appreciate the call. I want to ask David Barno for what you said about name the war that we've won since World War II. David?
No, I think that's a legitimate question. Certainly the first Gulf War in 1990-91 is probably the best example of a clear-cut military victory. A lot of these other campaigns are more murky campaigns. These counterinsurgency fights that they became in Iraq and Afghanistan tend to be many, long, long wars. If you look at history of those kinds of conflicts, they last sometimes for decades, and the American people grow tired of any kind of a war that lasts for that long. So, some of the military would argue that we won the war in Iraq by 2011. We came out, and then we had to go back in again several years later. That's a legitimate point of view as well, I think. But again, some of these wars are much more clear-cut than others, and when you have a specific objective that you're trying to achieve militarily, you achieve that as we did, for example, in 1991, then those wars tend to be cut and dry. These other more complicated wars, and I think what are going to be the nature of the wars for the next several decades are going to be wars in the gray zone, as we call it, or wars in the shadows that are going to be perpetual wars that are going to last at a long time at a much lower level of national effort.
Rosa, this is something that I wanted to ask you about, given what David just said. We see that U.S. troops and Iraqi military are gathering again outside of Mosul to move in on ISIS again. Do you think David is right that the nature of the kind of warfare that we'll be fighting lends itself to these perpetual clashes, because you might remove ISIS from Mosul and then you turn your attention back to Al-Qaeda, where they're reconstituting in a place like Libya. And just as you do that, there's ISIS back needing some attention again.
I do. And I think this goes back to something we were discussing earlier about the ways in which the lines between war and not war have gotten a little blurrier. That increasingly the kinds of threats we're facing are in that gray zone area that Dave referred to, that space in between what we traditionally think of as, full-fledged war and peace. And I think we need to shift to thinking of conflict as the military is in many ways already done in terms of their own military doctrine, shift to really thinking and taking it to the next step that we have a spectrum of conflict and we have to figure out how to operate in that zone where things are rarely going to be clear cut. And we're going to have things like terrorism are, in some ways it makes more sense to see them as perpetual challenges that we will have to perpetually manage, not as a war that we will win or lose. When you're fighting Germany, when you win, we know where Germany is. We know who runs Germany. We know we have somebody to whom we can go to and say, okay, do you surrender? When the conflict is against these groups that are constantly morphing and the location of the threat is constantly changing, you don't have that. You never will have that. So we'll never win. I hope we'll never lose either. We have to figure out how to manage those threats in a way that is financially affordable and in a way that's consistent with our values. And that's a very different kind of challenge.
Isn't this why you believe that the future of warfare, I think this is in that chapter that I mentioned about individualizing warfare, is going to look more like law enforcement than traditional warfare?
I think the problem is that we're going to have everything at once, that the old-fashioned war is not going anywhere, unfortunately, as we see in Syria, mm-hmm. that there will still be conflicts, and in some of them that the U.S. will be drawn into that will involve ground troops and air power and people being blown to smithereens and a lot of danger and a lot of risk, both to U.S. forces and to enemy forces and to civilians. At the same time, we are also going to be managing these more law enforcement-like kinds of activities, sometimes in the same place at the same time, sometimes in other places at the same time. And we're going to be using tools that in some ways, again, are borrowed from law enforcement of, intensive intelligence gathering, capturing when we can, much more individualized focus, whether it's on capture operations or surveillance or killing operations, where we are not going after the Germans or the Iraqis, but instead we're looking for you know, so and so in this town, and we want to get him, and we're doing everything possible to avoid getting anybody else. So I think that that's the huge challenge facing the military, is that we are going to need to do all these things, that we have the capability at least to do all these things at once, and that is really, really hard because they're so radically different. And then you layer on top of that all the kinds of prevention and information gathering and relationship building activities that we also need the military to be doing. It's a monumental task, even for an institution as large as the U.S. military is.
David, can you speak to that?
I think that's exactly right. The reality is that the U.S. military continues to be the best resources of any arm in the federal government. The military budget is somewhere north of $600 billion a year. If you added up all the potential categories of money that the State Department can draw on for its activities, it doesn't come out to be $60 billion a year, yet we expect the State Department to operate around the world, to be able to advance U.S. diplomacy in different parts of the world, to do many of these tasks all the way from the low end of the conflict spectrum in Iraq and Afghanistan, being out there in provincial reconstruction teams, to, you know, negotiating with Russia on ceasefires in Syria. They're very under-resourced for that mission. In fact, when Defense Secretary Bob Gates was in office a few years ago, he actually tried to move money from the Defense Department to the State Department to help them have more resources to do their job, and he was blocked by Congress. So this inevitably causes the military to have to take on more of these tasks because they've got the resources to do it, and the other parts of the government that in some ways ought to be doing these things and are designed to do these things just don't have the money from Congress and the resources and the capability and the numbers of people they need to get the job done.
Call here from Todd in Minneapolis. Hi, Todd.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
I'm a veteran, a Service Academy graduate, and my time in the service absolutely affects how I look at candidates.
Mm-hmm.
But realizing that the military is probably over-resourced, to your point, to do too many jobs, and candidates really don't understand the entire workings. We haven't had a candidate that served in the military since McCain ran. And they don't understand the culture. They don't understand all the tools. So I tend to look at how they look at a problem strategically,
mm-hmm.
to the point of a clear cut goal and objective, and how we get in, influence world dynamics with the military as a tool, as opposed to we're going to go in and we're just going to, you know, do this. We're going to do that. We're going to do that. With no plan or no goal or no exit, there are certain lack of insight in some of the candidates as to how to set clear strategic policies.
Yeah, Todd, I think that's really interesting. I want to put that to David. So he looks at the logic and the strategy in the absence of actual military service. What do you think of that, David?
Well, I think from what I can see so far, there's been a significant lack of detailed strategy and plans outlined by either candidate, frankly, at this point in time, on what they would do to change the current, you know, U.S. national security and foreign policy approach in the world. I'm not sure once they actually got into office that they would find that they could make sharp right turns and move the ship at 90 degrees from where it's been going because of the complexity of the environment out there. There are certainly different things you can do. Rose is exactly right, and you're right to say when the military gets orders, they're going to go and get it done. But I'd also take issue with the idea that the military is constantly out there saying, send me in, coach. I think the senior leaders in the military are probably more averse and more conservative and more limited in their enthusiasm about getting involved in military operations in any other part of the U.S. government. They understand what that means. They've paid the price for that themselves. Most of them, including me, have had children serve out in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as serving there ourselves. And so they're going to be very, very cautious about what they recommend in terms of getting into military operations because they know how easy it is to get in and how difficult it is to get back out again.
Rosa, I want you to listen to something that Donald Trump said recently about some of these confrontations that are happening between U.S. ships and Iranian ships. Let's listen.
When they circle our beautiful destroyers with their little boats and they make gestures at our people that they shouldn't be allowed to make, they will be shot out of the water. Okay? Believe me.
I find that alarming. Do you?
I find it alarming as well. And, you know, a lot of people make a lot of rude gestures, both at U.S. military personnel and at all the rest of us. You know, if I shot every driver who gave me the finger in heavy traffic, I would be in prison many times over. I mean, we live in a dangerous world. Not everybody likes the United States. Not everybody will ever like the United States, no matter what we do. And we don't need to pick fights with them. I actually think that most of the personnel who serve on those beautiful destroyers that Trump mentioned are probably mature enough to handle it if the Iranians make rude gestures at them. You know, we've got bigger things to worry about, quite frankly, you know, bigger geopolitical issues to worry about than having a bunch of Iranian sailors give us the finger or whatever the Iranian equivalent of that may be. I have no idea. And I think that, you know, part of what any sensible political leader, whether they have a military background or not, has to do is they have to figure out which battles are worth fighting, which battles can we successfully fight, which are things where people are trying to draw us in to conflicts that will actually divert us from more important things. And this is an example of exactly that, you know, that if we get sucked in every time anybody tries to provoke us, then we will be fighting perpetual wars everywhere on Earth, and we will lose because no one can do that. You know, you got to pick your battles.
And David, I want you to hear what Hillary Clinton said about that, which really kind of speaks to what Rosa just said. Let's listen.
He is temperamentally unfit to hold an office that requires knowledge, stability, and immense responsibility. This is not someone who should ever have the nuclear codes, because it's not hard to imagine Donald Trump leading us into a war just because somebody got under his very thin skin.
Okay, there's a lot of politics in that, but what she's saying about the provocation, David, what would you say?
I think the big message there is that the American people are going to have to look at both of these candidates and make their own judgment about their suitability, not just to lead the nation and improve the economy and not just to, you know, select the next Supreme Court justice, but their ability to lead the nation as the commander-in-chief. They are the folks that will give orders to this military. And as Rosa pointed out, when you tell the military to go do something, they're going to go do it. And there are far fewer checks and balances to prevent or slow down, caution you from being able to do that as commander-in-chief than there are any other elements of the government. You've got Congress, you've got the American people, you've got the press, all sorts of barriers and checks and balances, if you will, in the domestic arena. You've got very few in national security and foreign policy. So the American people are going to have to look at the candidates and say, who do I trust to do this? Who do I trust to be able to make these decisions to send America's, you know, young men and women to war? And going to war is serious business. I mean, this is not a sports match. This is not a bar fight. Using lethal force by American military force around the world is a very, very serious business. And it has all kinds of consequences in terms of escalation and involving the nation in wars potentially in every corner of the world. So I think that's a huge issue in this election that really hasn't come to the fore yet. And I hope it does before the first week in November.
Well, which leads me to this question, and I have about 2 minutes left. David, what is the one key question that if you could ask a question at Monday's debate, you would ask?
What is your strategy for better positioning the United States in a world that is full of threats, and how are you going to do that given the limited resources we have as a nation to apply?
You think that's specific enough? I can hear a lot of big generalizations coming.
Well, I can, you know,
answer
if
to that.
I was a skilled politician, I could answer any question with big generalizations.
That's true.
I'm not. So I think that'll be one of the challenges for the moderators. How are they going to get the candidates? You know, we talked a little bit earlier this morning about strategy. What are the two candidates' strategies for dealing with a contentious world, and how do they differ? We haven't seen that, I don't think, from either one in any level of detail yet. And that's pretty important when you think about the next 4 years or 8 years in the world that America is now inheriting, that's much, much different than the world even 5 years ago. So we haven't heard much of that, and I hope we do perhaps on Monday night.
Really grateful for your time this morning and your insight, David. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Carrie. Thanks.
Rosa, what would be your question?
I think it would be a variant of Dave's question. I think I might say, given that even the United States cannot do everything everywhere, on what basis will you decide how to choose your priorities? Do you see this as terrorism? Is it China? Is it Russia? Is it building global institutions? Is it climate change? Because it can't be everything. And I think the inclination of political candidates to say, oh, my priority is everything. But the world doesn't work that way. And to sort of press them on saying, no. Limited resources, which and on for what reasons? Give us some coherent set of principles on which we should decide where to put our resources and where we should leave things alone.
The book is called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. Rosa, such a pleasure. Please come back. Really good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much.
You can read more about the book on the thread, and you can find any of my conversations. If you have to duck in and out, you can find them on the podcast, including that show yesterday about the Wells Fargo fraud and whether we trust our banks. You can find that. And Carl Hiaasen Talking Volumes, that's going to be on the podcast as well. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.